Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Over Our Dead Bodies, Undertakers, Lift the Lid, by Kenneth McKenzie and Todd Hara. Narrated by Gregory St. John, Brian Troxell, and Ray Kaplan.
Chapter 1. There's no such thing as a normal day. Even though I knew it was coming, it was still a shock, as it's supposed to be, as my front doors crashed back on their hinges and policemen flooded in. I found myself staring into the business end of a lot of pistols, and I think a shotgun or two. I don't really remember. When there are guns pointed at me, my mind tends to go to mush. "Against the wall!" a voice behind one of the pistols commanded. And though my mind was shouting, "I'm the owner! I'm the owner!" I merely stumbled up against the wall as the wave swept past me, less one officer who gave me a pat-down. From the parking lot, I could hear the screams of a man overshadowed by an officer yelling, "Stop resisting! Stop resisting!" In retrospect, the day hadn't started out so bad, and if I had known, it would have ended with Biotech, a crime scene remediation service, scrubbing blood out of the carpet and off the walls. I never would have gotten out of bed that morning. No funeral is worth that kind of aggravation, not to mention being frisked like a teenage girl on prom night. It was a Saturday, deceptively sunny and warm for what grief the day would bring. I arrived at my place, McKenzie Mortuary, located in Belmont Heights, Long Beach, early, made coffee and took messages off the answering service, and then took Ruthless, my golden doodle, for a walk around the block before locking him in my office. My morning routine complete, I went into the chapel to get everything ready for the Revis service. I had dressed and casketed Mrs. Revis the day before, and sometime during the evening, the hairdresser had come and done her hair and makeup. I checked the makeup and, satisfied, set about transferring all the flowers from the flower room to the chapel and setting them up around the casket. Arranging floral tributes is a tricky art. We always set the family pieces closest to the deceased. The closer the degree of kinship, the closer to the casket, followed by coordinating colors and styles. Therefore, what might look best isn't necessarily what is set up because of how close or far from the casket the piece has to sit due to kinship. Mrs. Revis had a large family. I filled the entire front chapel wall around her casket with flowers. I tinkered and fussed with all the floral arrangements, and, finally satisfied, I set out the memorial folders and guest book in the lobby, and set up the Casio keyboard that one of the family members would play during the service at the front of the chapel. I spent the remaining time until the family arrived with a cloth and bottle of Windex, shining up glass, mirrors, and furniture. Nervous energy, really. Mrs. Revis's son Charles and daughter Jeanette arrived shortly after 9 a.m. with their families and went in and viewed their mother. As is my usual modus operandi, I waited a few minutes, heard some muffled weeping, and then swept into the room with a box of tissues. "Is everything all right? As far as her appearance is concerned?" I inquired. Charles, tears in his eyes, replied, "She looks wonderful."
20 years younger," Jeanette chimed in.
I beamed inwardly and simply nodded, "Good. If you need anything, I'll be in the lobby greeting your guests." Charles took that opportunity to pull me aside. He had that look in his eye.
"Look, Ken," he spoke in a whisper, "there's some tension in the family."
"Oh," I replied. "There usually is. Combine the emotion surrounding the death of a family member with the impending estate settlement, i.e. money, and you can have a tense situation."
"Yeah, my two younger brothers didn't have much to do with my mother."
I nodded. I knew he had two brothers because they'd been mentioned in the death notice.
"I don't know if they'll come or not. I hope they don't, but if they do, they might cause trouble."
Oh, great, I thought. I wished he'd let me in on this little tidbit of knowledge days ago when we had made the arrangements. I have in the past hired off-duty police officers to sit in for funerals where trouble was expected. Instead, I reassured him. Don't worry, I deal with this all too frequently. I'm sure it'll be fine. Famous last words. It'll be fine. It wouldn't be. It's amazing how calming the presence of a uniformed officer merely sitting in a lobby can be. In two instances, I've had them spring into action to prevent a disaster, but getting an off-duty officer with no notice on a Saturday was out of the question. I'd have an easier time conjuring a genie from one of the urns in my showroom. I knew I'd just have to grin and bear it, and hope. As it turns out, hope wasn't enough, not by a long shot. I knew them as soon as I laid eyes on them. They slunk in like two wolves, all easy strides and furtive glances behind wayfarer shades they didn't take off, even in the dimness of the mortuary. I extended the sleeve of my newly pressed suit to point at the guest book. Sign the book, please. Not a glance in my direction, they just glided by. There they are, I thought. The prodigal sons have arrived, and I was correct. The wolves set up camp at the foot end of the casket opposite Charles and Jeanette. When a guest arrived, they would greet either the camp at the head of the casket or the foot end, never both. There was a clear division in the family. Thankfully, everyone behaved during the visitation, and if it was half as uncomfortable for them as it was for me witnessing it, then it was a pretty painful hour for the family members. I was glad to get all the guests seated and get the service started. My chapel has pew seating with the center aisle, and I was guessing by who sat on what side which camp they sided with. I went into the deserted lobby and let out a sigh of relief. Everyone would behave during the service because it was structured. Whenever there has been a problem in the past, it has been during the visitation. That is the unstructured part, when people can find ways to get into trouble. But people sit in silence and listen during a service and generally behave. I didn't know it, but this was going to be a first. The service sailed along smoothly until it came time for people to offer testimony. This is when members of the audience get up and share thoughts and memories about the deceased. Each of the children, even the wolves, got up in turn and read a little something they had pre-written about their mother. It was very touching. Anyone else care to testify? The considerably sized clergywoman asked. A man, in a three-piece suit, sitting on the side of Charles and Jeanette, stood up and walked up to the microphone. He identified himself as Earl, Mrs. Revis's brother. Without preamble, Earl started right in. Ray and Sam, he said, pointing to the wolves, you ought to be ashamed of yourselves. He jabbed a finger at them. You treated your mother poorly, a God-fearing woman. She didn't deserve that. It's shameful, just shame. One of the wolf brothers stood up and yelled, you wouldn't visit her either if she'd cut you out of the will while your siblings stood by and took your share. Besides, who are you to stand and give judgment? Charles' red face stood up and said loudly, maybe if you hadn't been stealing from her, she wouldn't have cut you off. A wolf, I wasn't sure which, stepped from his pew. I was in the back frantically motioning for the clergywoman to step in and take control by making a cutting motion across my throat. Stealing, the wolf said. Is that what you call it? Guess you didn't tell Earl what you... Charles cut him off while advancing toward him. Don't you say it, you no-good thieving liar! They met at the center aisle where the casket sat. I was running down the aisle yelling, stop! When the wolf yelled, you lousy son of a bitch! As his fists connected with Charles's face. There was an audible, stomach-turning crunch as Charles's nose broke. I stopped as I saw an arc of blood spray across the interior cap panel, the inside portion of the lid, and Charles slump against the casket, pushing it into the wall with a loud bam. The force of the casket toppled several floral pieces. It was totally silent
for a second, and then the place erupted like a powder keg. It was like a fight out of an old western. Men began leaping over pews and going at it, grabbing the giant marble pedestals from under the flower arrangements and throwing them. Even the women were setting into it, clawing and scratching and swinging their purses around. I turned tail and ran to the lobby and grabbed the phone on the receptionist's desk and dialed. 911, what's your emergency? The voice on the line asked. I'm calling from Mackenzie Mortuary. There's a... I racked my brain for exactly what the situation was. Riot going on. A fight? No, many people fighting. A riot. Send police, fast! I heard her say, stay on the line. As I dropped the receiver and yelled at a man grabbing a big, heavy brass sign that said, sign guest book, please. Hey! I yelled. The man with the sign ignored me. Another man emerged from the chapel, and the man, armed with the sign, took a mighty swing. Thankfully, the unarmed man ducked because the sign drove into the drywall with a thud and stuck. As the man tried to free the sign, the man who ducked decked him, kicked over the guest book stand, and fled out the front door. The man who had been the aggressor lay on the floor, blood leaking from his head. I started to venture over to him, but he suddenly sat up and shook his head as if to clear the cobwebs, and I jumped back behind the receptionist desk as if the faux granite laminate peninsula was some kind of substantial barrier. The man freed the sign from the wall and ran into the melee in the chapel. I should have stayed in my little safety zone behind the receptionist desk, but I had a visceral urge to see what was happening. I ventured toward the chapel doors. Several clients who were making funeral arrangements poked their heads out of one of the small offices. I could tell, by the puzzled looks on their faces, they weren't sure if they should be scared of the ruckus or not. I made a frantic motioning with my hands. Get back! Get back! I whisper yelled. Police are on the way! The puzzled faces quickly disappeared and the door closed. As I approached the chapel, several people fled the scene, and each time I jumped over to the far wall as if to hide. Luckily, they were too intent on fleeing to bother me. Emboldened, I ducked into the rear of the chapel, and what I saw shocked me. The casket was toppled over, and everything that wasn't bolted down had been tossed everywhere, ostensibly used as weapons. All my precious antiques were mostly shattered. Flower petals and blossoms poured from the sky like a ticker tape parade. The floral arrangements had been thrown and rethrown and rethrown. And of course, the blood. It was everywhere. The walls, the carpets, the pews. I wanted to cry, but instead I shouted at the top of my lungs, "Police! The police are coming!" Nobody paid a lick of attention to me, and then a wooden tissue box cover hit me in the face. Really, it just grazed my jaw, but I was disoriented for a few moments. When I got my bearings, one of the rioters, a scrappy little guy with a ripped shirt, was screaming, "Police! Police are here!" The mob listened to him. The place emptied out like somebody had fired a gun. In mere seconds, I was alone in the wreckage of my chapel. It was deathly silent compared to the screams and shouts of a few moments prior. I swooned not from the minute pain in my jaw, but from the destruction done to my chapel. I returned to the lobby to make sure the rioters had left the building, and that's when I came face to face with the boys in blue and a couple of nasty-looking weapons. They moved quickly through the building, a neat little train of shields and tactical gear. I heard, "Police! Police! Open this door!" as they moved through the building, then frantic calling from behind the door, "Hold on, we have to move some furniture." There was muted scraping and thumping as furniture was moved and the door opened. The officers did a quick once-over, and seeing there wasn't a threat, moved on through the building. I heard distant pounding, followed by, "Police, police, open up!" I winced when I heard the crunch of a splintering door jamb. I was still being corralled against a lobby wall when the officers that had searched the building came back. The apparent team leader flipped the visor up on his helmet and reported to a man in sergeant's stripes who pushed his way into the lobby. "Nobody here, Sarge, but a few people in this office." He motioned to the office where the people had barricaded themselves in. "And a terrified dog. No gun?" "No." The sergeant looked at me hard for a moment, and then went and peeked into the chapel, then came back and asked the officer with the visor on his helmet, "Any other ways out?"
Plenty. Could have gone out any of them. We just know he's not hiding in here. We searched every square inch. Sarge turned his attention to me. What's going on here? He demanded.
You tell me, I said a bit too shrilly. I called you because there's a riot going on in my building.
He inspected what I saw to be my wallet that had been taken from me during the search. He looked at my ID, then me, then back at my ID. You're Kenneth McKenzie? He finally said.
Yes, that's what I was trying to tell you when you had the guns pointed at me.
He twitched his mustache and squinted at me hard before saying, Let him go. The officer guarding me stepped aside as if to tacitly acknowledge my newfound freedom. Sarge flipped my wallet at me. Of course, I missed. Sorry about that, Mr. McKenzie. I wasn't sure if he was referring to having weapons pointed at me or the premature toss of my wallet. He was about to say something else when an officer stepped inside and whispered something in his ear. Mr. McKenzie, Sarge said, seemingly embarrassed. The members of the Rivas family would like to know if they can view their mother one last time. I bristled, but then remembered my professional obligation. Fine, I said. Your men can escort them in, I said, shaking my finger at him, one by one for a last look, and then you can tell them if they want any further information about their mother, they can contact the medical examiner's office. I am turning their mother over to the state. Minutes later, I stood in the lobby, holding a paper towel full of ice to my jaw, and glowered at the family members as they were escorted in shackles. The officer escorting one of the wolves muttered to me on the way out, They really did a number on your place. Sarge later told me that as the first responding officers arrived, family members from the mob told them there were people in the building with guns. He thinks they tried using that as a ruse so they could slip away. Their plan didn't succeed. The officers tased several of the more unruly funeral goers in the parking lot, hence the screams I had heard. All they found was me, some bereaved people hiding in an office with furniture piled in front of the door, an employee or two, and Ruthless hiding under my desk. Needless to say, I now boycott the phrase, It'll be fine, because I've learned the hard way that sometimes it won't be. No matter what you do or plan for, sometimes you find yourself literally and figuratively at gunpoint. Though this story is outlandish, the point of it is, no 2 days are the same. This is one of the reasons why I chose the profession. Most days have a more positive outcome than having their facilities trashed and guns pointed at them. But I wouldn't trade this job for any other job in the world. In fact, I couldn't imagine doing anything else. Chapter 2. The Aftermath of a Suicide. Ken's Story. If you open your own place, you'll fail and commit suicide, just like your father. Those are the exact words Dick said to me when I told him my plans of quitting his employ and going out on my own and opening a mortuary. Nice guy, huh? The memory of those words still makes my blood boil, but I think they are why I have succeeded. It was a personal challenge. I took those words and embraced them in a death grip, like a python squeezing its prey. It's no secret that my interest in this profession formed because of a tragedy that befell me at a young age. My dad committed suicide when I was 12. The compassion of the funeral director that handled my dad's services sealed my fate. I don't think that's a unique phenomenon at all. I've come across scores of other funeral directors throughout the years who say they were called into the profession after experiencing a death in the family and seeing the ministry the funeral director provided. The most vivid memory I have surrounding my dad's death is Charlotte's Web. My parents were separated, and my brother Kevin and I were at my dad's apartment the night before his death, watching TV, and Charlotte's Web was on. Of course, my dad was on the phone fighting with my mom while we were parked on the moss-green Berber carpet watching the color tube in the wood cabinet. It was a serial, so after a half hour, heavy with commercial breaks, the announcer said something to the effect of, "Tune in tomorrow for the exciting conclusion." When the show ended, my parents were still fighting. The next day, Dad, a physical therapist, dropped Kevin and me off at Pioneer Park Pool on his way to work. We stood in the dusty parking lot watching him drive off. A comical scene because he was 6'7" and usually drove around in an MG midget. It was during the gas crisis and the midget was easy on gas, but he still looked like he was riding around in a clown car. That was the last time I ever saw him. His hulking frame wedged into that tiny blue MG, its taillights receding down the boulevard. I didn't linger on the sight. Kevin and I were too eager to get inside where my other siblings were already waiting for us. Mom was supposed to pick us up, and when she didn't come, the four of us, standing in our dripping swimsuits in the gravel parking lot, shrugged and raced back inside the gates. We were thrilled Mom was late. It was a rare treat to get to stay late at the pool. Finally, a family friend, Karen, came to pick us up. We were splashing around when Karen came in and systematically rounded us up one by one. I remember that for some strange reason, Karen's daughter was crying. But I was too young to sense the tension in the car and happily rode to the farm where we lived, making fun of Renee for crying. I grew up on a farm in Nevada City, a small city located between Reno and Sacramento on Route 80 at the base of the Sierra Nevada Mountains. The farm wasn't a commercial farm, but it was a working farm. We raised livestock and crops for personal consumption. That's where Dad did it, at the farm. As Karen drove down the gravel drive, I saw a bunch of strange vehicles parked in the yard and my mom standing in the porch. She had the most peculiar look on her face. And all of a sudden, I knew why Renee was crying. Someone was dead. "Kids, I have something to tell you," my mom said in the yard on bended knee. The four of us clustered around her. After the initial emotional and physical frenzy, I asked her, "What happened? How did Dad die?" "Wouldn't you rather just remember him as you knew him?" she asked, deflecting. "No," I said stubbornly. "I want to know." She looked at me for a long minute, her face red and streaked with tears, and finally said, "He shot himself, Kenny." All at once, I felt myself in that vacuum of space the recently bereaved seemed to enter into, where I was emotionless and puzzled by that fact. I knew I should be upset, but I felt like I was a million miles from anything save the words, "He shot himself, Kenny." I was totally weightless, floating in outer space, with those words repeating in the periphery, "He shot himself, Kenny." Later that night, I found myself back in my dad's apartment, parked on the green carpeting, watching the conclusion to Charlotte's Web for a lack of anything better to do. I remember thinking to myself, I started this show with Dad alive, and now as it ends? Nevada City was such a small place that my dad had dated the funeral director, Paula Bateman, in high school. After high school, Paula had married the man that ran the local funeral home, and when he died, she took it over and ran it on a widow's license. Paula, bless her soul, put up with the curiosities and incessant questions of a 12-year-old during what must have been, for her too, a very hard time. It can be a very emotional time for me these days when I handle services for a friend who has died of natural causes. I can't imagine what Paula was going through emotionally as she handled the funeral arrangements for a man whom she probably loved for a short time, who had met with a sudden and violent end. I have this vivid memory of my dad lying in his casket. He looked like himself, but because he was such a vigorous man in life, it was odd to see him so still.
People say things to the effect of, "She doesn't look like herself." And I don't think they can necessarily put their finger on why that person lying in repose doesn't look like the person they knew. In most cases, it's not the physical appearance. It's the stillness, the complete and total lack of animation. I know that's what it was for my dad. The stillness. Though it was a little unnerving and upsetting seeing my dad, I'll forever thank my mom for letting me view him. A lot of parents would want to shelter their children from that, especially 30 years ago. But my mom was progressive in that respect. The upset feeling faded quickly as I worked through my grief. Some days I feel like I'm still working through it on some level, but I still retain that picture in my mind of him, laid out in his suit, looking so peaceful. The catharsis of it all came at the repast, held at the farmhouse. The cleaning crew had worked hard to clean the scene up, and there were still giant industrial fans blowing in the house to try to dry out the carpeting, among other things. Bored with all the adults and their plates of salad and cold cuts and hushed talk, Kevin had the bright idea of seeing what would happen if he tossed a piece of toilet paper behind the fan. The giant metal blade shredded it and sent out millions of little pieces like snow. Well, that was it. We began grabbing huge handfuls of toilet paper and tossing them behind the fans and watching in delight as they chewed them up and spit out toilet paper snow upon all the black-clad mourners. I hadn't laughed so hard before then, nor do I think I will ever laugh so hard again. The mourners sat there, plates balanced precariously on their knees, taking our punishment because nobody wanted to be the one to yell at the kids who had just lost their father. Because I grew up on a farm, I was no stranger to driving tractors and other pieces of machinery from a young age. It wasn't unusual for my mom to say, "Kenny, can you back your dad's truck up to the barn and clean it out and wash it? Mr. McGee will be by later in the day to pick it up." The GMC Jimmy had sat idle for the 3 weeks after my dad's death until my mom decided she didn't want to look at it anymore and ran an ad in the Union, the local newspaper, and sold the truck. I dutifully trotted out to the truck and climbed in. When I reached down to rack the seat forward, my hand brushed something strange and square. I pulled out the cube of styrofoam holding 49 45 ACP rounds. One hole, the one in the corner, was missing a bullet. Instinctively, I knew what I was holding. I felt like I was choking. Carefully, I laid the cube on the passenger seat and sat in the interior warmed by summer sun, studying the dust motes. After a few minutes, the overwhelming choking sensation passed, and I cranked the engine. The engine turned over a few times before catching, and when it did, the 8-track player clicked on, and Cher's cover of Bob Dylan's All I Really Want to Do blasted through the speakers. That was the last song Dad had listened to. When that thought popped into my head, the choking sensation returned, and it was a few moments before I was able to collect myself and engage the clutch. Those sensations of choking eventually became less frequent and severe, then disappeared altogether. And I know now that physical manifestations like that are a normal part of the grieving process. Somehow the whole experience surrounding Dad's death and watching how Paula handled everything rattled around in my brain for the next few years. By the time I graduated from high school, all those ideas had congealed into what I knew my purpose in life was. I was going to be a funeral director. I registered as an apprentice with the state of California when I was 20. My first job was with Lakewood Memorial Park in Modesto. I was the typical apprentice. I did all the grunt work, like sweeping the parking lot, emptying ashtrays, and running errands. But I also started to learn how to embalm and to conduct services. Looking back, I did an inordinate amount of graveside services, and I think it's because Modesto is in the middle of the state, and it gets hot there. Nobody else wanted to stand in 110-degree heat, so why not send the apprentice? And let me tell you,
Those cemetery tents trap the heat and make it 10 times worse. The sweat would just roll down my back during all those gravesides. The one thing they wouldn't let me do, however, was make funeral arrangements. The manager said I looked too young. At 20, I probably looked 15. This is something I would hear many times during my career until I opened up my own place.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?